This is an interview with Mark Jeeves, recorded for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. I'll be speaking with Mark about his life as an educator in horticulture and a Tasmanian native plant and exotic plant expert. The interview is taking place on Wednesday, the 3rd of May, 2023, at Claremont, Tasmania. The interviewer is Jean Elder, and our recorder is Rhonda Hamilton. The Australian Garden History Society acknowledges traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island cultures and to elders past, present and emerging. So Mark, you were born in 1958 and in Jeeveston, isn't it? Tell me about those early years.
Well, I was born in 1958. My mother and father had been married 9 months to the day before, so I'm a wedding night baby, the first grandchild to both sets of grandparents. So my dad was an only child, and my mum only had one sister, but it was 10 years between them. So Auntie Carrie and I are closer in age than my mother and my aunt, really. So it was like having a big sister, really. So we had a very interesting childhood at Port Ewan. We were very encouraged. We had a mother who was brilliant, really, very clever, and really encouraged my brothers and I have two of them, both younger than me, to be interested in particularly the natural world. We had enormous collections of things like fossils and shells and scraps of bark and feathers and God knows what. I remember once we found a snake skin, and we had a big specimen cabinet in our spare room at home, and Mum opened the drawer and nearly dropped dead because of the snake skin. But you know, we were really encouraged, but we were also encouraged to draw and paint and create. And we were dragged around the country every weekend looking for plants, because Mum was a very keen amateur botanist. But I think I had no chance to escape an interest in horticulture, because when Mum was breastfeeding me, that's when she learnt her botanical Latin. So she used to feed me and sit with the book propped up on the table, and she'd be learning and saying her Latin while she was feeding me. So I learnt Latin very early. And then, you know, we had a childhood that most children wouldn't experience anymore. You know, we were away from first thing in the morning till almost dark with the dog, building huts and exploring the countryside. We didn't have a lot of close neighbours, so we were, my nan and pop lived next door, and we had apple orchard, so our whole lives revolved around the apple industry, and otherwise we were pretty set free, really.
And your mother was, it sounds like an amazing childhood, your mother, Kay Jeeves, was the foundation president of the Society for Growing Australian Plants, which later became the Australian Plant Society of Tasmania, and she was awarded an OAM for this services. So gardening, as you've said, and garden and growing plants and understanding plants and their Latin names was very important to her and to you.
There's a long history of gardening in the family. So my great-great-grandmother, whose name was Harriet Lomas, she had an extensive garden at Ewanville, and it was at a time when, you know, the palette of plants wasn't as big, but she always grew really unusual things. So we grew up with stories about her. But I was lucky until I was 12 to have a great-grandmother, and her name was Ethel Cruz, and she was an amazing gardener as well. They used to laugh about her. She'd go out to empty the teapot and Grandpa would be waiting for breakfast, and 2 hours later she'd be out pulling weeds in the garden. She didn't come back. But she loved alpines, and she grew things like auriculas and gentians at a time when most people didn't have them. But also she had this huge fernery at the back of the house where they grew Dicksonia, Antarctica. But also, you know, when we were little kids, there was probably, as mature, sassafras, and she grew myrtle. So they were interested in just in plants. And then my grandmother, mum's mother, was Mary Darcy, was another great gardener. And then, of course, mum. But very early on, my two brothers and I were given plots, and we had our own little gardens. And, you know, Nan encouraged us to grow cuttings, and she'd give us bits and pieces. And when I was young, mum was still into exotics, so we had exotics, and then the natives started to creep in. And
how did that occur?
Well, I think it was mum's association with the Society for Growing Australian Plants. How it came about is my great-grandparents, mum's grandparents, she used to go and stay with them. And there was a magazine, and I can't remember what the magazine was, but in that magazine was an ad for the Society for Growing Australian Plants in Victoria. So mum, being interested, actually contacted them, and she became what they called an alone or country member of the Victorian region of the Society for Growing Australian Plants. And through that, she met like-minded people here, and there were people like the Simmonses from up the north of the state who were very interested in acacias and then wrote books about them. She met Melva Trehanis very, very early on through that same thing. And, you know, for a while she corresponded with them and wrote for their newsletter. And then Thistle Harris, who wrote a lot of books on growing Australian plants, became very friendly with mum and encouraged her to start a Society for Growing Australian Plants group here in Tasmania. And the first meeting was something, I think it was 1963-64, and that first meeting was held at Essie Huxley's house down at Longley. And out of that, they decided that they would start a group here. And mum was the first president, Melva Trehanis the first secretary, and I think it was Alan Gray was the first treasurer. But, you know, there are still other people still around who were at that first meeting. And out of that, they formed a group in Hobart, and it was just called the Hobart Group of the Society for Growing Australian Plants. And eventually that grew, and they had a northern group and a northwestern group, and that's still the same today. But then we became a region in our own right, so now we have a state council as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, remarkable story, remarkable history there. Yeah.
Mm, there is.
Now, in all this busyness of having a wonderful life as a kid, did you actually get to school? Where did you go to school?
No, we did go to school. We went to the little Catholic school at Jeeveston, Sacred Heart, my aunt taught there. My mum was pretty involved with the school. And the year that I reached grade six, the school went out of secondary. So there was a lot of thought about what would happen and what we'd do. But mum decided that we'd go to Signet, to St James over there, because they went to year... I think they went to year 12. Anyway, I was there for a couple of years. But my brother, my middle brother, who was a very bright boy, mum and dad sent him to Dominic College, and he was a boarder. So he was there for a year before me. And then there was a bit of a plan by my mother, my grandmother and my father, so it was his mother, that I would go to the mill to work at 8 p.m. And Mum went, I don't think so. So Mum couldn't get me to boarding school quick enough. So that's, and then I went to boarding school for, I was 3 years at boarding school and loved it. And I actually never went home because I actually then got my first job in horticulture. I worked for AJ Connor and Co. And they had a garden centre, and I worked there. That was my first job.
Tell us about AJ Connor. A department store?
They were a department store where Spotlight now is in the city. Well, I think they might have even moved out of there now. But they were there, and they had a garden department. And I'd just finished school. I was 18, and that was my first job. After a couple of years, I actually then went into hospitality and had a whole another career before I came to horticulture.
Mm. After Connors, though, did you go to Westlands or
So while I worked for Connors, Westlands used to supply all our plants. So to help my knowledge, I used to go and work for them on the weekend up at Pottery Road when they were up there. So every weekend I worked up there and learnt a lot about plants.
So it was a second job?
It was sort of a second job. So it was really good fun, actually. I learnt a lot.
And that's where you learnt so much about?
Yeah, that was my first. Yes, that's when I first really started interest in growing plants myself. But then I went off on another tangent and went to a different career altogether.
Just finishing, before we talk about that, were you with Westlands when they moved to Seven Mile Beach? Or
No. It was before they moved to Seven Mile Beach. So at that stage, old Mr. Vanderstay was still in the business, and he and his wife lived up in Pottery Road, and the rest of the family all lived there as well at that stage. And then later... they moved down to Seven Mile Beach.
And you said then you did a sideways move, or I don't know whether sideways or a different move, to hospitality. How did that come about?
Well, I used to go to a restaurant called Bojangles, which was a bit of a...
still there?
Yeah, it was an institution in town. And they were looking for somebody, and I used to go in there for a drink or a bite to eat. And one day, David Seepin, who owned it, said to me, "You ever thought about working in hospitality?" And he said, "You know, I'd give you a job." And I thought, that sounds like fun. So I did. And it changed my entire life. So I was there for probably a couple of years and then moved on to other things, joined the hotel industry here in Tasmania, and then travelled. So I used to work for the Four Seasons Group, and they were opening a new hotel in Jabiru in the Northern Territory, the Crocodile Hotel, and I was asked to go up there as a manager.
Had you had any training in hospitality at this point?
In-house.
Early 20s,
yeah,
you would have been?
Yes. In-house? Yes, lots of in-house training. Went up there, and it was the most amazing place. It was the first time I'd lived away, and Kakadu was just mind-blowing, really.
And very different plants there.
Very different plants. But, you know, when you've got an interest in plants, you soon recognise, you might know the plant, but you'll know the family, or, you know, you can pretty well pick what things belong to. It was... The thing that amazed me about Kakadu was the change between the wet and the dry and what happens when the wet starts. So you get all these amazing species, arum lilies and all these incredible things that flower triggered by the wet. But, you know, there's some amazing, amazing things there. But also the wildlife's just... There's nowhere else in Australia where you look out and there's a million geese on the Billabong. You know, it's just the most incredible place. So I had 2 years up there, and then I moved across to Fort Douglas. And that was at the time when Christopher Scase had the share at Mirage. Port Douglas was a very glamorous place, but we had distant family in Port Douglas who I'd never met before. But also the rainforest up there is just so incredible, and I had the opportunity to do a fair bit moving around Port Douglas and getting out often out into the wild, up on the Atherton Tablelands or up into the rainforest, and I'd never seen plants where the flowers came out of their trunk and all that sort of stuff. So that was a pretty amazing place, and I had 2 years up there, and then went to Sydney. And worked for, I moved over to, I'd been working for Radisson, who's a big American company. That was where they were in Port Douglas. And then I went down to Sydney with them.
And so by this time you were late 20s, having all these extraordinary experiences.
Yes, that's right.
And how did it come to end that you moved from hospitality back to horticulture?
Well, I said to myself, if I ever started hating the customers, it would be time to get out. And, hospitality in many ways is a young person's life, and it can be very rewarding, but it does take a toll. And I just had enough, I think. So I resigned and came back to Tasmania and went, oh, my God, what have I done? I haven't got a job. What am I going to do? So I did a little bit of casual hospitality work until I saw an ad for a horticulture course at TAFE, and I thought, well, I've always been interested in horticulture, and Mum and I talked about it, and she said, you've got to do what you want to do. So the day that they were doing the application, I arrived. And luckily, I arrived early because it was the biggest intake they'd ever had, and there were huge lines of people wanting to get into horticulture, and not everybody got in, but I was about third in line. So I did. And I did 2 years.
What years was this?
This was in the mid-1990s, so 94, 95. And I did a certificate of horticulture, then an advanced certificate. And the then manager of horticulture said to me at the end, well, what are you going to do? And I'd already been working casually up at Plants of Tasmania Nursery, but they could only give me 2 to 3 days a week.
That was the year of Will?
Yes, Will. Yes, I worked for Will Fletcher. I learnt a lot working with him. But it wasn't enough to keep me sustained to earn a living. So Laurie Miller, who was the head of horticulture, said to me, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, well, you better stay then. And he gave me a job. And we used to laugh. I said, one day I'm going to have your job, And anyway, that's what happened in the end. So I became the head of horticulture with people who had been my teachers. I was now their manager. I really enjoyed my time in horticulture. And
can I go back and say, who were the key outstanding teachers for you at that time?
So I worked with Lindsay Campbell, who's now a very well-known landscaper. Laurie had worked for the Ag Department and he'd done a lot of work on vine weevil, which is a big problem in Tasmania, especially in the nursery industry. So I learnt a lot from him around how to manage that and the use of things like Suscon Green. And so they were my big influences within horticulture. And I suppose what I got really interested in was plant identification, which is probably one of my specialties, and propagation and design. And I also took over from Lindsay. They were running a thing called Tasmanian Native Plants course. And because I was with the Plant Society, I used to be able to encourage young people to do Tas Native Plants but join the Plant Society. So it was, you know, double benefit. And, you know, I've got lots of people out there now who work very seriously in horticulture who started off in that Tasmanian Native Plants course. Catherine Shields is a perfect example. Catherine is a very talented garden designer, but she didn't know about Tasmanian plants, so she came to me and did the Tasmanian Native Plants course.
Can I just interrupt you, because I just want to quote, because it was such a lovely quote that Catherine gave when we interviewed her, and she is talking about how I asked her how she'd learned about, and she said, it was hugely important for me because I came here from Britain about to start designing, and I can remember, she's laughing, driving in the car with somebody and they were talking about the plants they could see as we were moving at about 80 kilometres an hour through the landscape. They were talking about the shrubs at the side of the road, and I can just remember feeling a huge sense of despair because to me they were just all green. And I thought, how am I ever going to learn about these new plants? So, you know, in Britain, an oak tree and a beech tree, they're significantly different, whereas here I felt everything looked a bit similar. So it was really important that I learn as quickly as possible, and I was very lucky that Mark Jeeves was running a course at TAFE, and that's where I'm learning about native plants here, and I did that course and the advanced course the following year. And Mark Jeeves is just, I mean, he's amazing. His knowledge is second to none. He knows so much about exotic plants and native plants. So there we are. That was accolade from Catherine. So it obviously was very important to a number of other people as well,
yeah.
I think.
Yes, and I've got lots of people that I still correspond with or are close to who did that course, who've gone on to do amazing things. And, you know, it's very, very heartening to know that, you had that sort of effect on people.
Yeah.
And that's the reward of teaching. You know, as an educator, it's the satisfaction is seeing people grow and achieve. Yeah. I've always enjoyed teaching. I enjoy sharing the knowledge that I have. And, you know, even today, you know, Catherine is still one of my best friends. And she will ring me up and she'll say, I'm doing this job here, what will I plant, or will this work, or can you suggest trees that we can use, natives. She's a very talented girl.
But just stepping back, Mark, you were talking about lots of people trying to get into the course way back then in mid-90s. What was the context for that? Do you understand why so many wanted to get into horticultural then?
I don't know. I think it was just about demand. Still, the numbers, and I don't know now exactly how many, but I think they're still pretty busy. It was just one of those periods when there were lots of people who were interested in horticulture.
Possibly native plants, because that was just taking off in the 70s and
80s,
wasn't
it? Yeah, it was. And I think there was a consciousness that just there was a new awareness of the use of natives. I've laughed with Mum a few times about, you know, the Society for Growing Australian Plants actually did its job very well. And, you know, now you would very, very rarely see an exotic planted by council or, you know, on roadscape, because the natives perform so well. And in some respects, we've actually met our aims, but now we've moved on to other stuff like, you know, conservation and disseminating important plants,
mm-hmm.
And you know, studying plants. You know, a perfect example would be Lamaitia tasmanica from down in the southwest. You know, it's only one plant, and it's pretty rare. But we went to visit that because as a family, we were related to Denny King. And Denny had found this plant, I think probably in the 30s. But he took a group, including Mum, who he knew very well, and he was a collector as well for the endemic flora. He took us to where it was growing, and we actually saw it in flower, and you know, nobody... You would be very hard-pressed to go and visit it now. But
perhaps for those who might be listening to this later, describe where Denny King lived. It's a pretty remote part of the world in Tasmania.
So he lived at Melaleuca, which is right in the heart of around Macquarie Harbour area. But he was a tin miner. His mother was a relative of my grandmother, so the Kings were distantly related to us, and we used to go down to Melaleuca.
Did you fly in those?
Fly
days?
In, yeah, yeah.
Land on the beach?
If we went to Melaleuca, we landed over where they did the tin mining, but then we also used to go out to Cox's Bight. So we had several holidays at Cox's Bight. Denny used to do things too, like take us to Bombay and drop us off there because there was a hut there, and we'd stay there and then he'd come back and pick us up. His sister lived down at Quiet Corner as well, and we'd go and visit them as well.
Did he identify other rare plants?
He was a very good observer, he recognised that Lamaitia tasmanica was different, and you know, it's a bit of relict flora. It is the only Lamaitia in Tasmania that has red flowers, all the rest are cream. It is probably more closely linked to the South American Lamaitias than... It appears in fossil record, this one plant, it covers a woody thicket, but it is one plant, and it's sterile.
Mm-hmm.
Mum, we collected material at that time, and Mum actually, because it was so precious, she put the leaves in, and the leaves actually calloused and then formed roots. But she grew plants. We had one in the garden and it flowered. But at some stage, and I think it was through Thistle, Brian Halliwell, who was the director of Kew Gardens, came out to Tasmania because he had heard, he knew about Essie Huxley and he knew about Mum. And he came to the garden and Mum gave him a plant of Lamaitia tasmanica, which he took back to Kew. That plant thrived at Kew in their glasshouse, and eventually someone stole it. But they had taken cuttings, and there is still a plant of Lamaitia tasmanica at Kew in their glasshouses, but it came from Mum.
Wow, that's quite a story.
It is. And there's a few, you know, there's a few interesting things like that about plants that were found that we've continued to pass around. There's a very rare Milligania called Milligania johnsoni that occurred on the beach at Lake Pedder. And Dennis Morris, who worked for the herbarium here and was another family friend, and a friend of Winifred Curtis, and we'll get onto that later, but he found a pink form of this Milligania johnstoni. It was, and it is the most beautiful thing, and it's only small, but the flowers, it flowers in little racemes, and they smell of honey. so strongly punny. But generally, you know, the type of specimen's white, but this is beautifully pink. And Dennis collected it, and he gave me a little piece. Well, we've kept that going for probably 30 years or more. And Sally Johansson, who is one of my very close friends, I gave a plant to her, and she, it loves to be divided. So she divided and divided, and then she gave a whole heap of it to Plants in Tasmania, so they were selling it for a while. But, you know, it's the story of a plant. It was one off, but, you know, through association and the plant society and that interest, you keep these things going.
It's huge, hugely a great contribution to, you know, our native plant life. Mm. Yeah, you were talking about Winifred Curtis. Tell us that story.
Well, it was probably a highlight of my mother's life, but it was for us as well. So, Tasmania, and I will answer, but it's a sort of bit roundabout. So, Tasmania is quite lucky in that it has a published endemic flora. Many countries don't have that. But Lord Talbot de Malahide, who was an Irish aristocrat, had property here in Tasmania on the east coast. And there's a big property here called Malahide. He was very keen on publishing an endemic flora. And eventually it came out in 6 volumes. Margaret Staines, who was an Australian botanical artist, but was living in London and working at Kew, did all the paintings. And they now, the originals, are all sitting in the museum in Launceston. And, you know, if you can get a look at them, they are pretty amazing. But Winifred Curtis, who, again, was, you know, a friend of Mum's, and met through really the she was an associate member, an honorary life member of the Plant Society. So she enlisted the Plant Society to help collect for the endemic flora. So we would have lists of plants that they wanted, and some of them were pretty obscure, and some of them, you know, you had to do a lot of travel to find them. But Mum was a very serious collector, and there were other people who Denny was a collector, Essie Huxley was a collector, and there were lots of other Mum's friends from across the state who collected. And if you look in the flora, every plate acknowledges who the collector was. So we would spend a lot of time out and about looking for perfect specimens. So they had to be perfect. So what happened is the specimens were collected by the collector. They were taken straight to Winifred, who did a description. And then they were flown straight to London to Kew. And Margaret would be painting them. And she had Brian Halliwell over her shoulder going, hurry up, because I want the cutting material. So a lot of Tasmanian plants came into cultivation in Britain because of the work with the endemic flora. But, you know, our flora was appreciated in Britain a long time before it was appreciated here. You know, back in the 19th century, things were travelling from here in Wardian cases back to Britain, and particularly in places like Scotland, they were growing a lot of our things. If you look at some of the introduction dates, you know, we're talking about the 1830s, 1840s. But we also had a very close association with Kew because of Joseph and Dalton Hooker. So, you know, there was a lot of material moving backwards and forwards very early on.
So what period of time was this, and how many roughly would your mother and all of your family collected?
Oh, I reckon there's probably 15 or 20 plates that Mum was associated with. It was in the early 70s. I'm not 100% sure of the first date, but it went on for quite a while because the volumes came out one at a time, and you know they are beautiful things.
Mm, wonderful. With again, we're jumping around, but I when you were working. What time, when was that? Tasmanian Native Plants. Did you also have the work with Jubilee Nursery with Ted and Joy?
I did.
The same era?
It's the same sort of era, yes. Joy and Ted became friends and they used to come to my... I had a big garden. I collected... besides, I grow a mixed garden of exotics and natives, but I have some very particular interests, and that's in Gondwanan flora and also species flora from South America, North America, Yunnan in China, and a few other places that interest me. So Joy and Ted, when they were up next door to Plants of Tasmania, that's how I really first, I used to buy off them, but then they realised some of the things that I had, they'd come and take cuttings, you see, and then they got me to do a little bit of work for them every now and then because they knew my plant knowledge was pretty good, if I do say so myself. So, you know, they used to get me to identify things for them as well. And because I had a broad network across Australia and you know, even overseas, getting unusual plants, you know, there are things in my garden that Sally says I'm probably the only person in Tasmania that's got that, and there's quite a few like that. But I also was very lucky to meet some really interesting people who had... nurseries overseas, and you know, was able to get things that were, it was easier then to get things into Australia than it is now. But somebody I dealt with a lot was Dan Hinckley from Heronswood in North America, and then he came out here because he's a friend of Sally's and she brought him to my garden and we took him bush, and you know, so. And I've met a lot of really interesting people that way. You know, Sally's very well known across, you know, Europe and North America as a great plants person, and I've met a lot of those people.
So how long, your garden at Port Huon in southern Tasmania, how long have you had this particular garden, or have you had several gardens?
So I have had several gardens, but the one at Port Huon, the first plants went in 1995. I was looking for a block of land because I wanted to see my trees mature. And my grandmother put on a little turn and said, there's plenty of land here. And I thought, what's that mean? So a couple of days later, I decided with Mum I'd sit down and talk to her. And I think my this is Mum's mother and father, always thought that when, because we all lived on the farm, and Dad and Mum built on the farm when they were married in 1957. Pop gave, as a wedding present, Pop and Nan gave them a block of land. Anyway... Nan and Pop always thought that Mum and Dad would move into our big old family home once Nan and Pop weren't there. But I think as things went on and my grandfather died and my grandmother was on her own for 20 odd years, she realised that Mum and Dad were very comfortable where they were and weren't probably going to move down the road. So she said to Mum, well, he wants land, I want someone to have the house, what can we do? So, you know, we talked it through and I said to Mum and Dad, well, there's only one way this is going to happen. I'm going to buy it because, you know, I've got brothers to think about and I don't want any rental over. So when Nan went into care, I bought the house. But I was already gardening around it because Nan had said, and then she said to me, it keeps on growing, Mark, it keeps on growing. You keep on moving the fence further and further out. But now I'm very blessed because I have some amazing things that are mature, and you know, people walk around the garden and go, "Oh my God, what's that?"
So how many? How big is the garden? How many hectares?
It's 2 hectares. Yeah, so it keeps me out of trouble. I get a hard time from my friends. We have a little group that we call the Garden Angels, and they say to me, "You're forever creating," because that's the part I like. And Sally says I'm the best plant hunter in Tasmania. If I want it,
you'll track it down.
I'll track it down, and they get me to track stuff down as well. But you know, you have successes and you have non-successes. Nobody sees the non-successes. You know, I've tried lots of things that are,
So that garden now, since you've had it, is how old? How many years have you?
So we started planting in 1995. There are quite a few things that are, 30 years old, 40 years old, and they're decent trees now. Mm. You know, things like Hallicia monticola, which is the American snowbell, is, you know, and I'll have to talk in the old, about 25 feet tall, flowers every year, you know, and it's probably, you know, you don't see it here very often. But I'm still trying new plants. I love the hunt, and I'd love to see whether they'll work in our environment. But,
so a mix of exotic and natives.
A mix of exotic and natives, but my big bent in exotics are with a Gondwanan and sort of feel. So, you know, I love things like Imbothrium and those sort of plants that grow in South America, which have a very similar, same family as we do in Tasmania or Australia. There's a few genus that I'm really, really interested in. Nothofagus is one. So, you know, I've got all the North Americans. You know, I'd love to be able to grow some of the ones that that appear in New Caledonia, but we're just too cool here. But I do like to push the boundary of what will survive, and some things really surprise you. I grow species rhododendrons. I don't particularly like the frillies, but I'm very keen on species. I grow more species than I do. Yeah, most of the exotics I grow are actually species, not fiddled with. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just where my interest is. And species oaks is another area I'm really, really interested in.
What range of oaks then?
So mainly North American I'm interested in, but I've got quite interested in, you know, the new frontier is Mexico. So I'm growing 3 Mexican oaks, new to cultivation, very spectacular, and they're doing incredibly well. So Quercus ricephala is new to cultivation, probably only been in cultivation 10 years, doing very well. And Quercus canticans that has huge leaves, reddish bronze new growth, and white indumentum on the back of the leaves, and is shiny, shiny on the tops of the leaves, is just the most beautiful thing. And everybody goes, "Oh my Mark, I can't believe you've got that." We had some people here from Herrenshof in Germany last year, and they walked around my garden, and Sally brought them down, and they just kept on saying to me, "I can't believe you've got that. Can't believe you've got that." So that was a bit exciting.
Oh, very exciting. Coming back to the your garden angels, who else is in who's in that group? Can you tell us a bit more about that group?
Yeah. Well, the garden angels are fun, and it has morphed over a period of time. So originally it was myself, Catherine Shields, and Sally Johansson, and then Lindy Campbell joined that. So Sally had Plant Hunter's Nursery up at Nika and is a sensational grower and is a huge influence on me. She is very generous and gives, every time I admire a plant, she gives it to me. So, you know, it's and she's given me things to try to see how it goes. And we always try to have an insurance policy between us. So, you know, you got to share the rare things because you never know. Things just drop dead overnight. Catherine is a landscape architect, and I know that you guys have interviewed her. She is a very, very talented girl. We spend a lot of time making lists together of things, like things that flower on bare wood and all that sort of thing. And then Lindy Campbell, who owned Island Herbs. She's just retired. But Lindy, although, you know, we're called Island Herbs, she grew a lot of really unusual perennials. You know, she's been a big influence and a person who's given me lots of things to try. And again, insurance policies. I had a plant that I... Well, two things that I've shared with Sally, for instance. Miligania johnstoni, we struggled to keep because in 2018 there were fires down in the Yuin, and we were forced to evacuate, and we were evacuated for 3 weeks. We had a shade house full of the most incredible stuff. We came home to find most of that dead because there were, you know, 40 degree days and the smoke, and we weren't there to water. So Sally had Miligania johnstoni from me. She was able to give that back to me. And, you know, if we hadn't shared it, it would be gone. There's a big grass. It's Ampelodesmos mauritanica. It comes from Mauritania and the African coast of the Mediterranean. It is the most spectacular grass. I had one plant. Sally loved it, so I shared it with her. Then I lost it. And she just gave it back to me. You know, so Garden Angels is very important to us. It used to be that we used to go and work in each other's gardens. We do less of that now. We do more of going to look at gardens or going to do things in the wild. We've just had the most incredible experience last summer. The Harts Mountains down the Yuin is our childhood stomping ground because my mother loved Harts and was where the first, she led the first excursion for the Society for Growing Australian Plants to Harts back in the early 60s. So we've tramped that area a lot, but there's always new things to find. So the Garden Angels went on a walk out to Emily's Tarn, which is sort of under Harts Peak, not visited that much. Anyway, we came over the little, there's a piece of Bolster Heath, and we came over and Sally had gone down towards Emily's Tarn, and there's sort of a soak, it's a little sort of creek. And you dip down into that, and I said to her, "What's that plant beside you?" Because there was this thing with the most incredible mushroomy, it's a mushroomy pink, I suppose, quite pink, bells. And I said, "I don't know what that is." And so she said, "Come down." So I went down to have a look, and I said, "I think I know what this is. I think it's an Archaea." Anyway, we photographed it, and I still have a student who had done Australian native plants with me, who actually works at the herbarium. So I contacted Matt and said, "I think this is this. What do you think?" And he went, "It is." park. It's Archaea cumbiae, but it shouldn't be there because it's never been recorded in Harz. So that was a great discovery by the garden angels. I wrote it up for the Australian Plants Journal, and it appeared on the cover. So that was quite memorable. But we've had another one too. So when we were that very early on, Mum led a walk to Harz with the Plant Society, and there's a plant called Milligania densiflora, which is a very spectacular lily. It's whitey cream, but at that time there were pink ones, and they were on the plane going across towards the top car park, and there was great excitement about these pink Milliganias. Anyway, a couple of people, Essie Huxley contacted Mum afterwards and said, do you think the wallabies eat Milliganias? And Mum thought, what's that about? And she said, we couldn't find those pink Milliganias again. And so, no, they obviously did eat them. But we've never seen a pink one there again until the last garden angels walked. And here we found a little group of pink Milliganias out at the same, on the way to Emily's farm. So, you know, the nice thing about garden angels is observation. We also do garden visits. We do things, and nursery visits. So we've just recently been up to Red Dragon up in the northeast, which is, a fabulous nursery. Mm. And Andrew's very, very knowledgeable. Sally and I have been up there 2 weeks ago on our own, and we were taken all out the back and saw what was in the stock houses and all that, so it was very exciting. But Andrew is very keen to spend a bit of time with me because
maybe he's going to join the Garden Angels, perhaps.
Well, he knows a few things that I've got that he's quite interested in. He is very into conifers, and I particularly like abies, and I've got it's fairly new to cultivation, one from Mexico, which is called Abies religiosa. And the reason is that it's a very Catholic country and they cut it and bring it into the church. So that's where it gets its name, religiosa. And it has the most incredibly blue lavender cones. Andrew's very, very keen to get that off me. But that's these associations, isn't it? Yeah, it's what it's all about.
So important.
Yeah.
So garden angels probably been going 20 years.
Oh, yes, it must be about 20 years or so.
Wonderful. Yep. Now, I wanted you to talk a little more about convergent evolution. Tell us about this.
Yes, well, so this is another thing I'm in really interested in. So convergent evolution is a recognition that for a particular environment, different plants adapt the same strategy to survive. A perfect example would be the Tasmanian cushion plants that you get up in the high alpine. So, you know, you have the same mechanism in New Zealand where they have, you know, their vegetable sheep. But also, the same strategy is adopted in South America by Bolax, which is a totally unrelated species. And here, you know, we have more than one family who've adopted that cushion plant strategy to cope with the conditions. But another group, and they're in different families again, in Tasmania we have what's called climbing heath, Cyathodes serenthoides, which is a spectacular heath that actually climbs in our rainforest. But in South America, there are three other plants, Lapageria being one of them, that are not related but adopt the same strategy. And there are lots of other examples where, it's all about unrelated species adopting the same strategy to survive in a similar environment. It's actually really interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. How did have you visited some of these other in China, South America?
More growing them.
Growing them, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how you've been learning
yeah.
about.
Yeah. And I first learned about convergent evolution when I was doing the native plants course, and I worked with another teacher called Janet Stevens, and Janet used to teach that part of the native plant course. I used to do the propagation and the plant identification, and she did that side of, you know, how things developed, what the mechanisms and all of that. And Janet and I are still friends. And you know, she first got me into that, and I've just got more and more interested.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating area, the whole, in terms of, yeah, what's happening and the links across the world, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. That's right. And you know, it's just not about plants either, and you know, I was trying to think of the name of this plant, and I can't. Well, it's not. It's a fungus. There's a fungus that we call orange fungus that occurs only on Lothophagus here in Tasmania, but there is an almost identical one that occurs in Lothophagus forest in New Zealand and South America. So, you know, there's all these links. It's and, of course, many of these links are because of Gondwana, you know, before mm-hmm. You had the split up of the continents. And that's an area I'm really, really interested in. Because, you know, flowering plants started in southern Gondwana and, you know, we're southern Gondwana. So, yeah.
Now, the other... throughout your horticultural career, you've also done, which you never talk about very much, but a heap of teaching through adult education. Not that that exists anymore in Tasmania, unfortunately. But that you must have done that for quite a number of years.
I did. I don't know how I first... I think it was because I was working for TAFE, and at that stage, adult ed sort of sat under our umbrella before it was taken away and given to Libraries Tasmania. So they were looking for teachers. You know, they knew I ran the Tasmanian Native Plant course. And they asked me, well, I think they might have asked Laurie Miller first, whether I'd teach. Anyway, he came back to me and said, "Yeah, it's a really good way to hone your skill because you're dealing with a completely different cohort. You know, it's people who you know, anybody who did adult ed did it because they really want to learn something, or you know, it's an interest." So I started teaching for them, and I did quite a few things. So I did propagation, landscape design. Plant identification, and I taught for them for a number of years, probably 5 years or so, and then of course adult ed sort of underwent a challenging time and sort of was, you know, it never really thrived when it went to Libraries Tasmania. Wasn't their core business really. But I had a great time.
And as a beneficiary of one of those courses, I can absolutely agree. You had a great time and we learnt a lot in garden design. Thank you. I guess we're getting towards the end of the interview, and I'm interested in your thoughts, about the future of native plants and plants... Well, you know, gardens generally, given the impact of climate change and environmental changes. Have you got comments on that?
I have. I, you know, Tasmania at the moment is surprisingly unscathed, but I don't think that will continue forever. and I'll explain what I mean. Tasmania's native flora, particularly our alpine flora, is what we call a relict flora. So it is a relic of an earlier time when we were wetter. And so a lot of things we treat as the climate changes, so they go higher. A very good example would be, not here in Tasmania, but in Queensland. There are a couple of eucryphias that occur on Mount Bartle Frere and Mount Bellenden Kerr. So Eucryphia jinxii and Eucryphia wilksii. You know, they only occur there because they've migrated up the mountains. But unfortunately, with climate change, they're going to reach a point where they can't migrate. Over the last couple of years, probably the things I've noticed that really suffer from the heat are things like Eucryphia. They'll drop dead overnight if we get these 40 degree days. We are probably still lucky in Tasmania that we tend to get a respite. We'll have a 40 degree day, but then it doesn't last for a fortnight or whatever. If that starts to occur, things are going to be very hard on the flora. Things, you know, adaptation to climate conditions takes a long time. But with the rapid rise in temperature and, you know, things, you know, I think the world's fiddling while Rome burns, we are going to get to a tipping point where we can't control. So that is going to really affect what we can grow. I notice at home I grow heritage apples because my family were the first people to grow apples in Jeeveston. So I've planted a copy of the things they grow. I notice, which never happened when we were children, we get those hot days, those apples cook on the tree. I don't think we really realise yet the sorts of implications that can come. Mm-hmm. You know, things in the garden, bolt to seed in the vegetable garden, that sort of thing. But I've been looking at, I'm very interested in this, and I keep a sharp eye on what's happening in Europe. And you see quite a bit now of people saying, okay, what will we be able to grow in 5 years, 10 years? In the latest Gardens Illustrated, there was, what's his name? The guy from Herrenshof has a list of plants that they think will do well in climate change in Europe. I think we need to start thinking about what is going able to survive moving on. I think our gardens will change. I'm not saying we won't be able to garden, but I think the palette of plants is going to be somewhat changed. Sally and Catherine and Lindy and I have been talking about sitting down doing a list of the things that we think will do all right. We haven't done that yet, but it's on the agenda. I think climate change is a very pressing, gloomy disaster on the horizon. Mm.
The Australian Garden History Society at the national level have got a national strategy re climate change. So in terms of our membership, they're trying to, every month now, information comes out in terms of things that are happening, ideas around the impact, which is important. And I wondered about the role of the big commercial nurseries. Have they got a role in this in terms of future plants and whatever?
Well, I think that's about dissemination. the nursery industries are dominated by fashion. I think people are more conscious now about you know, water conservation, what we'll do all right. And that is the job of those big nurseries, to disseminate those plans. And you know, you walk around a nursery now and you see a lot of things that are, we may not have seen here in the past. The other thing that I think, you know, from looking at somewhere like the Plant Society, you know, Mum was saying to me before she died, you know, she thought that she and Dad had the best of it, and there were plenty of challenges ahead. But we'd been noticing, Mum was a great observer, and you know, commenting about how things were flowering out of season, or the flowering season had changed, and what effect that must have on the wildlife who rely on that plant. You know, there are plenty of challenges ahead.
Did your mother document, I mean, many of the things she's collected have been documented, her observations in other ways?
When Mum died, and it was pretty traumatic because Mum was a very bright person, but she got Lewy's body dementia, and Mum was gone in 3 months. Mum kept extensive records, so on everything she did. But she was a great filer, so everything in her office, you know exactly what's in that folder. But also, there were 7 banana boxes of handwritten diaries that she kept every day. And she was also a great documenter using film. She walked in my garden every day, but she was a great observer in the wild. There are about 100,000 photos, I reckon, including slides. But all meticulously, every box, every slide has written on it where it was, what it is. So there's this record going back to when we were children, really. And Mum was a great observer of the natural world. As she got older and, you know, it was harder to write because of arthritis, she then moved to birds and was a great bird observer and wrote that up every day.
So what are your family going to do with these wonderful records?
They're in my cupboard at the top of the stairs, and I have been wading through them. We've been working with the Plant Society because there's a lot of history around the Plant Society, and we are going to work there's a thing you can do. You can set up a repository, which is called an eminence persons file. So we'll work with what are they called?
The archives.
The archives. Yeah.
State archives.
Yeah, the state archives.
Oh, wonderful.
Because you know, a lot of that history, you know, there's lots of stuff. Because Mum was also a representative on the South West Committee. You know, there's a whole another history there about the work she did there. She was on the Lake Pedder Committee. You know, she was very. Melva Trehearnes was one of her best friends, and you know, Allagus, before he was drowned. You know, we used to go to Pedder with him. So there's all the record about that as well. And you know, there's another whole bit around. You know. They used Elspeth Vaughan and Max Angus and Patricia Giles all used to paint, and they'd come to Pedder, and so that's how we met all of them. And yeah, so we had a very charmed life with my mother. And my father just agreed. So we'd be driving somewhere, and Mum would go, stop, there's a plant. And he'd just sigh and pull over. But he was a good observer. Dad was a bushman, very good observer. So he encouraged Mum a lot, which was really good.
Some remarkable stories, Mark. Now, before we do conclude, are there any other things you want to add that we could probably talk for another hour? But I'm just wondering, are there any things you here we haven't covered in terms of plants, horticulture, the future?
Well, I am sort of coming to the end of my working career. I am working on a project at the moment. We're building a new campus for the team that I now work for. That's a very significant project, $30 million build. We get the keys in a week. I've said that we'll bed that in, and you know, I've told my bosses that I will stay until I'm 67. I'm 65 at the moment, so I've got a couple of years working, but I do want to spend some time in my garden. And there's plenty of new plants that I want to try. There are plenty of things to find out there. The one thing that amazes me about the Tasmanian flora is there's always a new form, there's always a bigger flower, there's, you know, and we still have a lot to learn about our native flora. I'm toying with the idea of when I retire that I'll go and do something at the uni around botany, because I'm still, you know, I'm an amateur botanist. But, you know, I know a fair bit about botany and Latin, but it always, in the back of my mind, I always think that we used to go on these walks, and I won't say who it was, but this person used to, we were kids, and would correct our pronunciation of botanical names in Latin. And one day, Thistlestead was there, and she said to this person, "For goodness sake, leave them alone. It's a dead language. It doesn't matter how they say it, as long as we understand what they mean." So, you know, I love passing on my knowledge. And, you know, I'm learning every day. In my garden, I keep extensive files on the plants. So, you know, when it was planted, where I got it from, then a description and the family. But also I have notes on how it's performing, and you know, there's quite a few that say died, but you know, I like observing that stuff, and I do like sharing the stuff I've got.
Oh, that's quite amazing, Mark, and I think I would conclude the interview and say you've made such an enormous contribution as an educator. Thank and you. I can say that as a recipient of that, and as and continuing your knowledge of native plants. We hope you're in retirement, you document and publish more about that. And yep. We also hope that all your mother's records get preserved. That, yep. What an amazing history. Mm, absolutely wonderful. So thank you again.
Thank you.
And thank you on behalf of the Australian Garden History Oral History Program.
Thank you.